Garen Boland.
Hi, Garen. Mark Jones calling from the Life Sciences
Foundation. Hey, Mark. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for taking time out for this. We're writing a history of the origins of the biotech industry. And of course, Genetics Institute is a big part of that, so we'd like to get your perspective on the history of the company over time. So,
great.
Maybe we could start out just getting a little bit of background of how you got involved with the company. You were at Arthur Andersen and a partner in 1980, right?
That's right. Actually, I was contacted by an individual who came to GI with Gabe Schmergel from Baxter named Mirza Mehdi. He was the initial, he was kind of initially Gabe's right-hand business guy. And Mirza joined right at the onset with Gabe and decided after a couple of years that I believe he was more interested in moving over into the high-tech field. And Gabe had said, that's fine. See if you can find me a replacement. And I had worked with Mirza at Arthur Andersen. In fact, he worked for me on an engagement or two there. So I guess he thought of me, contacted me, and it was right around the time I was thinking about leaving public accounting and getting out into industry. So timing-wise, it was a precipitous call, and you know, I wound up coming out here three or four times, talking to Gabe and others at the company, which I think was only about 30 people at the time I was interviewing, and basically a bunch of scientists, Gabe, Mirza, and a couple admins, and I never really had a particular interest in science or healthcare, but the whole situation was fairly intriguing to me. And I also knew that Boston was a very entrepreneurial community, so I figured, why not give it a shot? If it doesn't work, there'd be a lot of other opportunities out there.
Right.
So I wound up joining the company in December of 1983.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about this progression. First of all, your decision to leave public accounting to what was your idea there? What prompted that?
I think I just I've been at Arthur Andersen for 13 years, and it was a great place to work. Worked with great people inside the firm, had great clients. But I was just ready to do something outside of the client service specter. So I was, at the time I got this call, I was just starting to think about, doing some looking around, putting out some feelers. And the call kind of preempted all that, so I never wound up looking at anything else.
I see. So you wanted to do something operational.
Yeah, I think, a lot of what I did at Arthur Andersen while I was in the audit division, I had a couple clients that were very heavy into M&A, and I wound up doing a lot of what's called general business consulting, and it was one of those things where, you kind of wind up getting involved in specific, projects or areas. You provide your advice, and, then you wind up walking away and never get to kind of be around in the environment and enjoy kind of the fruits of the consulting. So I think it was more of, more a matter of getting into an operating environment where I could feel like I was going to be an ongoing part of a team and, creating value in the enterprise that I was working in.
Right. And the GI opportunity was intriguing. What about it was really caught your interest, or made it seem like this is the right way to go?
I think it was the fact that it looked like there were going to be a broad range of opportunities in biotechnology, but frankly, it was a little bit like throwing darts at the time because it was the pretty early days. But I just thought the idea of finding new ways to deliver in the therapeutic healthcare field sounded interesting to me, and I hadn't worked in a scientifically based environment even as a in a consulting role at Arthur Andersen. So it was the idea of a new field that looked like it had some real potential that if it was successful was going to be able to deliver something that could be very important.
And do you remember, if you can put yourself back into that context, and maybe what you're aware of or not aware of at that time? You know, Genentech had gone public. I mean, was that on your radar screen anywhere, the fact that this is really, that there was some demonstration?
It really wasn't. Mm-hmm. I was aware that it was still a pretty small field at that point in time. You could probably count, you know, the number of companies on two hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some general awareness of the players in the field, but I didn't really get up to speed on that until after I was in and, you know, up and going at GI.
Right. Did you perceive any risk in making this career shift?
Absolutely. You know, my wife was ready to kill me at the time because I'd worked for a long time, worked very hard to make partner at Arthur Andersen, was finally making some money. I had a little bit of control, a little bit more control over my schedule. You know, she and I are both from the Chicago area. All the roots were there. All the friends were there. We didn't have any friends in Boston. So, yeah, I perceived risks. But as I said before, I just felt that Boston, again, was an entrepreneurial community. There would be opportunities if, for some reason, GI didn't work out, to bounce into something else. And I got a little bit of a flavor for the Boston community because I did an internal working review when I was at Arthur Andersen of our Boston office, the Arthur Andersen Boston office, and they had a very strong practice in Boston at that point in time. So I knew a few people there, so there were some connections. But yeah, I perceived that there were some risks, but they were risks that, you know, I was in my early 30s at the time, and I just figured, you know, if for some reason things didn't work at GI, there are other companies, other industries, and other opportunities to look at.
Yeah, and you were persuaded that the folks at GI were a fair enough bet. Gabe Schmergel, and who else did you talk to when you're deciding to make the move?
Well, I think, you know, Gabe was the principal influencer, you know, internally, but, you know, the company also had, you know, a pretty decent range of, you know, blue chip relationships at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the board was a pretty strong and savvy board, you know, with key people from Whitney, Greylock, and Benrock on the board.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, GI had worked with Morgan Stanley on a private placement that, you know, was completed just before I got there, working with, you know, top attorneys at the time, Hale and Dorr, now Wilmer Hale in Boston. So, you know, they just, and the, you know, two founders had a good reputation at that point in time also. So, you know, it's like a lot of things. You know, it's important to be working with good people. People that, you know, I felt I could learn from, and also that, you know, I think were, you know, respected in their own professions, and that, you know, dealt on a fair and level way. And, you know, everything that I had been able to glean from a diligence point of view on, you know, Gabe and the, you know, the kind of the outside advisors that were associated with GI was very positive.
Mm-hmm. So when you arrive at GI and you're surveying the landscape, what was there for you to do? You formulate a plan when you arrive, and I presume in conjunction with Gabe and others, but what were the needs of the company at the time?
Well, I think, you know, there were a couple of things. The company didn't really, per se, have a business plan at that stage. I mean, you know, we were working in a lot of different areas. We were working in the therapeutic area, therapeutic drug area. We were doing some stuff in agriculture. We were doing some things in, you know, the enzymatic area. And it was pretty clear that I think the company was going to have to start to develop some focus and develop, a more structured business plan. So I thought that was a great opportunity to get in and learn as much as I could, as quickly as I could, about, you know, what the thinking was to that point in time, what the company was doing at that point in time, and work together with people inside the company and, as needed, outsiders to, you know, to help formulate, the type of definitive business plan as you would do for an operating company that had products and revenues, but something that, you know, tightened it up a little bit from in terms of, you know, what we were going to have to do going forward. The other thing was, it was a very light organization at that point in time. And, you know, there are going to be, I think, challenges of how do you build it out, what types of people do we need to bring in, that sort of thing. And, you know, I was always interested in that. And, you know, I basically came in with responsibility for finance and admin. So, you know, started working, you know, pretty early on the human resource side to try and, you know, again, figure out, based on where we thought we were heading directionally, what kind of organization did we really need to build? Obviously working with Dave on that also, what types of people we need to bring in.
Yeah, and did you have the sense that Gabe was borrowing a lot from Baxter in the way he wanted to structure things, his idea of how things ought to be put together?
No, I think Gabe was very open-minded about it. Gabe's a pretty analytical guy, and I think he always looks at things very objectively. He doesn't let, you know, prior experiences necessarily bias him. He certainly, you know, he learns from those experiences and takes things away from them, but he's very objective about it. And I think it was pretty much an open, you know, kind of an open hand at that stage as to, you know, how we did things. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where we sit down, the group of, you know, 2, 3, 4 of us, and try and figure it out together.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the problems that you encountered and some solutions that you brought to bear?
I don't know that there were major problems. They're more or less, you know, probably, growth challenges that any organization has. Mm-hmm. Again, I kind of commented early on that we were spread out and doing a lot of things. And, you know, from a strategic point of view, one of the decisions that we needed to think about was, you know, how broadly did we want to continue to partner and collaborate versus, you know, holding assets back and developing them on a more proprietary basis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we were, you know, one of the early biotech companies that partnered pretty aggressively. You know, we were maybe a little bit more conservative on the financial side than other companies, and didn't want to necessarily have to rely on going out for, you know, major rounds of equity to finance, you know, a growing or expanding business. We wanted to balance and be bringing in, you know, money from partnerships, which meant, you know, giving up some of the value of the assets that you're working on. So there was always that question of, you know, how much of that do we do? We wanted to, I think we felt that we needed to be working in multiple areas on multiple programs because I think we recognized, you know, the inherent risks of drug development. And we believed that we needed to spread things around. And the way we felt most comfortable doing that was a more aggressive partnering, with a more aggressive partnering strategy than others were taking at the time. And I know we were criticized for that, you know, in a number of corners. You know, I think in the end it probably served us pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And when you say spread things around, at some point you focused, I'm assuming, on different drug development projects, but how long did you carry on with the other things, like agriculture and I don't know what else you're doing, enzymes?
Yeah, I'd be guessing on that, but I would say, you know, maybe we were still working in those areas my first 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. So probably, you know, up through, you know, 86, 87. But then we were working in the diagnostics area. Mm-hmm. On top of therapeutic drugs. So I think we were in 4 different, you know, general areas at that point in time. And as I say, I think most of that, I think we had drilled down and got most of that back into just therapeutic drug discovery and development, probably 3 to 4 years out from when I joined.
Mm-hmm. And were there any of these projects that you sort of reserved for just for GI? Was Factor VIII, was Baxter the partner for that, or?
Yeah, that was actually an early partnered program, and that was that partnership was in place when I joined in late 83. So mm-hmm. The hemophilia area, Factor VIII was already partnered. There was a partnership in the diagnostics area with Allied at the time. I think those were the two that were in place when I joined. And then we did, you know, obviously more partnering after that. And what we tried to do on the partnering side also was to do geographic deals as opposed to global. So, you know, there are a couple situations where we had arrangements that strictly covered Japan, a couple other arrangements that strictly covered Europe. So we were, you know, we were looking to, you know, retain ownership, but not necessarily, you know, for the full product.
Right.
Some geographic ownership.
Yeah. And you did give up some rights and potential revenues down the line, but did that put you in a position where you maybe didn't have some of the financing crises that, that a lot of other biotech companies went through?
We might have had less. We still, well, we, you know, we had a major financing crisis when we lost the EBO suit.
Yeah, that was later, right? Yeah, that's, yeah.
That was later, because we were humming along, you know, with four or five, you know, very aggressive programs, you know, building out infrastructure in the company, and, you know, we had counted on doing some, you know, additional equity financing, and, you know, that had a pretty significant blow, and I'm sure Gabe took you through this, but we really had a fundamental decision to make of either trying to find, you know, a source of significant new equity capital or really, you know, reducing the size of the company and putting some programs on hold. And in the end, you know, after some machinations, you know, we wound up doing the deal with American Home Products, which provided $300 million of fresh capital and enabled us to keep marching on the, basically on the same beat we were before the EBO decision.
And I'd like to hear more about that. Were you involved in, deeply involved in negotiating that?
Yeah, it was basically Gabe and I and the outside attorneys and Brett Frank.
Well, and maybe we could just talk about it right now. Could you describe that process? You're looking, what made you just, you know, you're saying, okay, we perhaps we need to do this, so you start to investigate it. And, you know, I imagine at some point there was a, you know, you realize, okay, yeah, we can do this. This is the way to go. How did you get to that point?
I think we, you know, I believe we wound up putting some feelers out. I think it was via Lehman Brothers in the pharma industry that, you know, we were interested in potentially a strategic, you know, relationship or collaboration. You know, not necessarily a full, you know, sale or acquisition, but trying to create an arrangement where, you know, a pharma company would come in and put a reasonably sizable investment into GI, obviously take some rights with that, but enable us to continue to build value. And, you know, we had some discussions with, I'm going to guess two or three companies that didn't really get too far. And then and Gabe might remember this better than I do, but American Home Products, I think, came in independent of that process that we had initiated because Gabe had a relationship, or knew, I believe, Fred Hassan at the time, and AHP approached us. And after they approached us, I think we then definitely arranged to have Lehman represent us in our transaction going forward.
And but you had been working with Fred on other talks with other companies.
You know, I can't remember. It was either Goldman or Lehman that was working for us on that, and I don't remember which one off the top of my head. Gabe might, if you ask him again.
Yeah. Well, Fred had put together the Genentech Roche deal, and I assume he was trying to do something similar here, and it was surely your interest, right, to maintain autonomy for Genetics Institute to the extent that was possible, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when AHP started, you know, expressing interest in GI, you know, we sat down with Fred, and I think We agreed, the board agreed that, you know, something modeled along the lines of, you know, Genentech Roche is something that looked attractive because it got, you know, as I said before, a very significant chunk of new equity into the company to enable us to continue, you know, driving forward. We obviously gave up a piece of the company, but the piece of the company we gave up, came at a premium to the market at that point in time, a decent premium to the market. And then we had the, opportunity, to basically as shareholders ourselves and for external shareholders to say, hey, we're confident we can continue to build value here, and you can realize that either via, AHP taking us out at some point during the ensuing five-year period at attractive prices, or, us building the market value, the value independently in the market, and if they decide not to exercise, you'll get your return that way.
Yeah. Did you have an expectation of what would probably happen, or did, talking to HP, did they give any sign, or did you have a preference?
I think we kind of rode both sides of that. On the one hand, the returns off of the escalating fixed, takeout prices was attractive. On the other hand, you get into a young entrepreneurial organization, you accomplish some things, and you like to think that, you can do better. So I think we were fairly indifferent as we went through that five-year period. You know, in response to your first question, I think that intuitively we probably felt that they were going to exercise at one point in time, but there was really no basis for that in terms of, necessarily signals or discussions other than, a gut feel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we're doing this backwards, but let's talk about the IPO. Okay, go back.
Yep.
This is 1986. And it was an successful offering. I think it's the figure was $79 million, something like that.
Yeah, it was, and it was at a nice valuation at that point in time, also.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the advantage of we went out later than the early higher profile companies did. Certainly, Genentech, Biogen were out very early, but Amgen, Chiron, I think Immunex, and several others were out before us. And, we had raised a fair amount of money privately, and we were kind of determined to not, jump the gun on the IPO.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to a point where I think it made sense to, open up broader options for financing going forward, which came with a successful IPO. So we made the decision to go, I think in late 85, and then got the process cranked up and completed the deal, as you probably saw in May of 86, if I remember correctly. But it was an interesting process. The banks were all over us because we had a reasonably high profile at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, it was exciting young times for biotech. So we had no problem having people come in and, make the pitch. Ultimately, it was a very close call between Goldman and Morgan Stanley, and we decided to go with Morgan based on the positive experience that we had with them in a private placement Series C round.
Mm-hmm. And were you involved in that, or was that before you arrived? That was around 1983, right?
The private placement took place, I think, just before I joined, like 2 or 3 months before I joined.
Mm-hmm. And there was some talk even then about perhaps going public, right?
There was, and I think that the thinking was, and again, this preceded me, but I believe the thinking was, we got a pretty nice valuation on that private round. Let's let this business germinate for another, couple of years, see where we can get it, and then, take it out at that point.
Mm-hmm. And I've got some notes here that you were at, there was an IBA, I guess, an IBA meeting, where you made a presentation about the valuation of biotech stocks, and you made some predictions about where this is going to go. You know, some firms are going to fail, others will be acquired, and you know, a very small number will, you know, become independent, standalone companies, and you know, certainly all that's happened. But this is 1986. Did that proceed the way expected?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I took a fairly conservative approach to, you know, trying to look out and see where the industry was going. It's kind of my nature to look at things from more of a conservative, you know, perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought that there was just a lot of happy talk and hype going on at that point in time, which, you know, I didn't really particularly care for. So I probably, my statements, I think I remember the meeting you're talking about, my statements were probably a little stronger than what they needed to be. But I think I was just trying to provide a, you know, a personal, you know, kind of grounding opinion to everybody that was running around with, you know, their satchels open, waiting to, you know, raise more money, more equity, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, these days, maybe the only real independent standalone company is probably Amgen. And, of course, it if you look at the history of this thing, it could well have been Genetics Institute instead, rather than Amgen.
Yeah, I put Biogen in. Biogen also.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure where they would be without IDEC. I mean, they're, mm-hmm. they're big now. You know, if they don't do that deal, maybe they get acquired. I don't know. But in any case, Genetics Institute took a big hit from the Amgen thing, which went on for a number of years. Right? Can you say something about, you know, how that affected life at the company and you know, decisions that were made and so on?
Yeah, I think obviously everybody was upset by it, but I always felt the company really kept its focus and kept driving forward. I think people were comfortable, you know, in the company that management would find a solution to continue to enable us to, you know, build the organization the way we were, you know, leading up to that decision. And you know, I think within a reasonable period of time, you know, we did pull the, we were able to kind of keep things going. We did raise a little bit of, you know, equity in an off balance sheet, you know, financing transaction. And, you know, I think that top management probably worried a lot more about it than, you know, the company in general, because the company in general had a lot of confidence in top management. And, you know, we're content to kind of continue to drive forward on, you know, on whatever areas they were working in, programs they were working on, you know, functions they were trying to build, whatever.
Mm-hmm. And how did you communicate these, you know, you've got this pretty serious thing. I mean, did it feel like it was hanging over your head for all this time that, you know, if this goes wrong, this could be bad, or were you confident that you would prevail in court? I'm not sure.
I always felt we thought we had a shot in court, but I think we also recognized that we needed to provide for, you know, continuing to grow the business if we were not to prevail in court.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think we, you know, if you ask people honestly, did we expect to prevail, I think they'd probably say 50-50, but, you know, you don't want to work in this industry if you got less than, you know, a 50-50 perspective on something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anytime you're in litigation, it's a crapshoot.
Yeah. And of course, all along there are efforts being made to stay out of court, but that didn't work. And were you involved in any of those negotiations with Amgen people?
I was involved in some of them,
mm-hmm.
But you know, I honestly don't remember a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, certainly, yeah, kind of came in. I was coming in. I wasn't necessarily in the front lines of those, but I was definitely in some of the meetings.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Let me ask you about some of the other partnerships along the way. The partnership with Burroughs, that was WellGen. I'm not sure what that is. This is something that you established in partnership with Burroughs.
Yeah, I was actually in the middle of all that. So even with our partnership arrangements, had I think with one exception, retained manufacturing rights for all the products we were working on.
Mm-hmm.
And we, one of the most challenging aspects of biotech back then was when do you start to build out manufacturing and how much do you build out? You have to start and make commitments well in advance to when you know you're going to have a real product, approved by the regulatory authorities. So we had acquired a piece of property up in Andover that, where we had a capability of expanding off of the existing structure. It was basically a lab and office structure. And we decided we were going to put some manufacturing capacity in up there, but we didn't think it was going to be enough in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So in parallel with that, we had had a partnership with Burroughs Wellcome in the TPA area early on in the company. And I think that partnership was still alive, but it wasn't clear where it was going and whether we were going to wind up, in the TPA business or not. But Burroughs Wellcome also wanted to, for purposes of their product pipeline, create some biologic manufacturing capacity in the United States. So we started talking to them and conceptually agreed to go in on a joint venture 50-50 basis, building a commercial scale biologics manufacturing facility.
Mm-hmm.
And we wound up selecting a site in Rhode Island just south of Providence, and the joint venture was named WellGen.
Mm-hmm.
And we went ahead, and I had direct responsibility for that program, the relationship, the joint venture. We had an independent board, two people from Wellcome, two people from GI, which were Gabe and I,
mm-hmm.
and a lawyer, I think, wound up forming the fifth member of the board. And they wound up doing a lot of the engineering. They had actually built out biological manufacturing. They're one of the early ones in Europe. So I had experience in the area, and that was another thing that was attractive to us, in addition to kind of sharing the capital requirement and operating, ultimately the operating requirement for the venture, the facility. They had a lot of experience both in engineering, building, and operating facilities, so we felt we could learn a lot from them and leverage into that. And so we wound up, engineering and building out this very large facility in Rhode Island. And I don't remember all the specifics, but about the time that was completed and ready to be commissioned, we had had a number of major productivity improvements in products that we were manufacturing on a pilot scale basis at GI.
Mm-hmm.
And we reached a conclusion. I'm simplifying all this, but this is essentially the way the thinking went. We wound up reaching a conclusion that we could handle everything we needed for the next probably 5 to 7 years out of our Andover facility, and that we really didn't need the WellGen capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So we then wound up going into a negotiation with Wellcome, and they, I think, conveniently, I think they felt that they were perhaps going to need a little bit more capacity than what was initially envisioned in the WellGen facility. I think, if I remember correctly, we were building out four separate manufacturing suites in WellGen, two large and two smaller ones, and we were going to take one small and one large, and they were going to take one small and one large.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the time that we reached a conclusion we didn't really need the WellGen capacity, they had an uptick in what they needed. So it kind of created a possibility to negotiate our way out of that, which we effectively did And I think I remember we completed that just after we did the HP deal. Mm-hmm. So that's the story of Welgen. And then eventually, Welcome wound up selling that facility to... It was either directly to Immunex or to the product that Immunex was, or the company that Immunex was partnered with. Mm-hmm. On, I can't remember if it was Enbrel or something else. I think it was Enbrel. Mm-hmm. It was the company that HP ultimately acquired, based out in Michigan, and the name is escaping me right now. Mm-hmm. But eventually, Welcome wound up selling the whole facility to them, and it became a an Immunex AHP facility, and then ultimately, then it became an Amgen facility after Amgen acquired Immunex.
Mm-hmm. There's some interesting issues with manufacturing. Well, one is with Burroughs Wellcome. What biologics products did they have to manufacture at that time? Were these things like vaccines, or were they partnering with other people, the other biotechs that were producing products?
I think there were a vaccine or two, but I think there was also a therapeutic, and I just don't remember off the top of my head what it was.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I think one of the products coming through their pipeline was Campath,
uh-huh.
Which they ultimately never wound up developing. I think now it's a... I think it's a Genzyme product.
Right.
Or Sanofi.
Yeah.
But that was coming through the pipeline, and I think that was one of the products that they were looking at as potentially needing pretty good size capacity to manufacture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you say that your was your strategy to retain manufacturing rights, was that sort of an easy thing to accomplish? Because if you're partnering with large pharmaceutical companies, a lot of times they really don't know how to do it, and they're relying on you.
Yeah, I think that was in large part the case. I mean, one of the more lucrative partnering arrangements we had was the Factor VIII deal with Baxter, and they had no biological manufacturing capability at the time we partnered with them, or at the time that we were developing Factor VIII with them. They ultimately built capacity, as that product moved toward the marketplace, or maybe shortly after it got into the marketplace. But yeah, it was the kind of thing that I think at that time pharma companies were willing to give up manufacturing rights. It'd be a lot tougher now with all the mm-hmm. the capacity that's out there, the expertise and capacity that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let me ask you a bit about, there was a suit, a countersuit at Genentech over TPA, and I believe this is after or about the time that Genentech got approval for their product. Were they ahead of GI in developing?
They were definitely ahead of us, and honestly, I don't remember that much about that litigation, because I wasn't really that involved in it.
Yeah, okay.
But they were definitely ahead of us.
Right. Okay, there was a partnership with Syntex. Were you involved in that?
No. Okay. And that didn't last too long.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember what it was, but that was not a major partnership and certainly not something we ever derived any benefit from in the end.
Uh-huh. I see. Are there any other important partnerships that we haven't mentioned yet?
Yeah, the couple that were again ultimately wound up creating good value for GI were a partnership on EPO in Japan with Chugai,
uh-huh.
and with Boehringer Mannheim in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And we wound up again manufacturing product in both of those instances and collecting royalties, so we got a pretty good chunk of the ultimate sales value, as we did with Factor VIII, from the partners on that.
Right. So the EPO, all the development that went into EPO, it was far from a total loss, right? You didn't have
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So you didn't have the American market, but then maybe. And I think Gabe might have went through this, but what put the company in such a bad spot? after, was this just on Wall Street, the perception on Wall Street that,
I think that's right. I think that, you know, people were, you know, starting to look at the market potential of EPO, and we actually did have a partnership in the U.S. with Upjohn on EPO, but, you know, that product never got to market. But I think, it was largely Wall Street, you know, put a lot of GI's valuation, you know, in, onto, you know, full proprietary, or I should say not full proprietary rights, but derivation of revenue, you know, from Upjohn in the U.S. And again, we would have manufactured that product for them. And probably didn't think that, you know, Chugai and Bayer were going to be as successful as they ultimately were in terms of, you know, product introduction and market share in Europe and Japan.
Yeah, and by then you had already made the deal with AHP, and is that the case? By the time they became successful, the product,
yeah.
Products? Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was your feeling then? I think it's 1996 that AHP does decide to exercise its option and purchase the rest of the company. Is that correct? 96?
That's right.
Yeah. What was your feeling about that? Did they give you any signals that was coming? And how did you feel about it?
No, I think we were down to the last quarter in terms of the, you know, the fixed option 5-year exercise period. Mm-hmm. And I think we, you know, they let us know very early in the quarter about that. And we, at that point in time, I think we were not at all certain they were going to exercise. In fact, at that point in time, we probably assumed they weren't because we were so deep into the, you know, the exercise period. Mm-hmm. So I think it did surprise most, if not all of us at that point.
Mm-hmm. And what was the reaction? I guess you had to pass the word on to the troops, right? What was the effect on the company at that point?
Well, we really couldn't. We had to hold that pretty tight because we were a public company at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our stock was trading, I want to say, roughly $20 below, you know, what the exercise price was at that point. The market was obviously betting against it big time.
Yeah.
So we had to keep that within a very tight, you know, small senior management group at GI, probably 5 or 6 people max.
Was that difficult to manage?
No, I think that, you know, we, you know, things had to happen pretty quickly, and, I think we wound up at that point, Gabe probably told you, hiring, Greenhill, Bob Greenhill had just formed his own boutique out of Morgan Stanley for investment advisory services. So we hired Greenhill to advise us on it, and we had, you know, obviously very good lawyers from Hale and Dorr in. And, you know, I think things moved relatively quickly. There was, you know, there's a, in spite of the fact it was a fixed, you know, price takeout, there was a fair amount of negotiation that had to take place in terms of, you know, how the company was going to operate going forward, you know, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, it got done, I think, in a very, you know, business-like and fairly efficient manner.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there was, you know, at that point, people in the company were pretty bullish on where we were heading because a lot of our programs were going extremely well. And at that point, you know, I think that the top management group, there were some people in the top management group that didn't want this to happen. I think I was one of the ones that argued pretty strenuously that, you know, we should take this. It was a pretty phenomenal valuation at that point in time. And again, looking at the risks of, you know, drug development and commercialization, I just felt that it was, for me, it was kind of a no-brainer from a shareholder perspective.
Mm-hmm. Right. What did it mean to you personally when you're looking ahead? I mean, did you have a sense of, you know, were you going to stay and or stay through a transition period, or what was your feeling?
I had a lot of feeling for GI at that point in time. I really liked the people in the company. I had, you know, roughly half of the 1,600 people reporting to me. And, I definitely felt that I would stay for, you know, some reasonable transition period, but had my doubts as to whether I would stay after that because I had a lot of experience working with AHP during the 5-year option period. Uh-huh. And, it's a pretty controlling organization. And I just didn't feel like that would have been the best fit for me going forward. And I'd been with GI for, 13, 14 years at that point. And, had a little bit of a desire once this decision was made, I started thinking that, I probably should do something a little different going forward.
Uh-huh. And
but I definitely felt that, I could be very helpful in the transition and, was definitely committed to that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then, how long did you stay before you went on to Syntonix?
It was a year.
Uh-huh, 1 year.
And almost, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that was an interesting process because, I worked very hard in that transition period on together with our head of HR to try and retain as much of what we felt was contributing to a very good culture at GI as possible going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, very inconsistent in a lot of ways with the way HP operated. And, we spent a fair amount of time with the HR and the finance groups. And, you have to realize at HP that the finance group was a very powerful group at that stage. So we spent a lot of time, kind of negotiating little things with them, being able to retain, the name and the logo and, some of the benefits that were, very different from what HP had going forward. And, we were making excellent progress on that and, had agreement on a number of areas that, and I thought it was really going in the right direction. As far out as, 10 to 11 months from the acquisition. And, the general thought was that GI was going to be run as an autonomous unit, reporting into AHP going forward. And that certainly made, retaining some of the things we were looking to retain much easier. And what happened, it was either in month 10 or 11, they reached a corporate decision that they wanted to integrate GI into the Wyatt Pharmaceutical Division, fully integrate us in and have us report in there.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was like, 10 months of negotiation kind of down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't lose everything, but we lost a lot of, what I thought were some fairly important, autonomy types of things. From that decision to integrate us into the pharmaceutical division.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was sort of a last straw for you, or were you already prepared?
Yeah, well, I was planning on leaving at the end of 12 months anyways.
Yeah.
It was sad in a way because we'd worked very hard, for those first 10 months trying to, negotiate as much autonomy as possible. And as I said, we thought we had made a lot of progress, and then all of a sudden this kind of 11th hour decision came along.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then your plan, you start Syntonix, you're a founder.
Here was my thinking coming out of GI. I had planned, I left in, probably would have been May or June of 86 or 87, I can't remember, whatever 12 uh-huh. months from the deal was. And I decided I was going to take 6 months off, sit back, and think very broadly about what did I want to do going forward. And I was completely open-minded about it. I wasn't necessarily certain I was going to stay in biotechnology. In fact, I even thought about possibly doing something in a not-for-profit area. But I was kind of committed to really maintaining an open mind, taking my time, and kind of thinking it through.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, I was probably out of GI for less than a month, and Gabe had connected with a couple of the scientific people that were trying to put Syntonix together at that point in time. And he said, you know, you ought to really talk to these guys. Why don't you just consult with them? He said, you know, I'd be willing to get involved if this thing gets off the ground. But why don't you just talk to them and consult with them and see if it looks like it's anything you're interested in doing? So I said, fine. I connected with them, spent, you know, 2 or 3 months kind of trying to figure out where it was going to go. And, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of get started on something and the adrenaline kicks in. And I said, gee, this looks pretty interesting. I think that, you know, I'd like to, you know, start this company up with these guys as CEO. Mm-hmm. And so it fell into place very quickly. It was totally unintended in terms of where I thought I was heading directionally. And, you know, I think we got Syntonix up and going. It had already been incorporated on paper, but we started it up operationally late, I think it was late 97 or 98. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Right. And after 13 or 14 years in the biotech industry, you felt like CEO, this is... you know how to do it, and you can make it work?
Yeah, I felt I had a reasonable shot. I mean, you know, I understood, you know, that a CEO role is completely different than any other role you can be in at a company, in any company, particularly in life sciences, and that it was going to be clearly a learning experience. But I thought I felt I had the capability to get this company off the ground and at least take it to a certain stage and then kind of figure out, you know, what happens from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the scientific founders a lot. So, you know, that's kind of got Syntonix up and going.
Yeah. Who were the scientific founders?
There were two brothers, Lawrence Blumberg, who actually was a really high-flying buy-side analyst for Alliance in New York and knew a lot about, he's an MD, by training, understood the industry really well, understood how investors looked at the industry. And his brother, Rick Blumberg, was head of gastroenterology at Brigham and Women's in Boston. Mm-hmm. So Rick was, and Rick had a couple other, there were a couple other scientific founders that Rick had kind of pulled together in the Boston area. But, you know, Rick was kind of the principal scientific leader, and his brother, Lar, was, you know, kind of combination on the science business side.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, listen, why don't we leave it there, and then when we get on to Volume 2, we'll call you back and ask about Syntonix and Certrus and Constellation. How does that sound?
I think I'd be content to leave it at Volume 1 right now.
Yeah, okay. well,
and, you know, if anything else comes up as you're going through all this process, feel free to, you know, get back in touch. I'd be happy to spend some more time if you have some other things that, you know, you think about after we've hung up.
Okay, great. Thank you, Garen. We appreciate your help.
Okay. Pleasure to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.